Good morning. It's time for In the Green Outdoors with Gail Martin and Carol Kelly. Each week, the ladies will bring you gardening and planting ideas, tell you about native Ohio plants, prairies and habitats, and great tips for everything in the green outdoors. This week with Carol Kelly.
Hello again, everyone. Before I get into today's topics, I must first apologize and make a correction regarding some information from my last segment of In the Green Outdoors. In closing, last time, I warned listeners that I'd seen poison hemlock blooming along the edges of fields, but that I hadn't yet seen wild parsnip in bloom. Unfortunately, my old brain slipped a cog there, for the yellow flowers that we have been seeing roadside these last few weeks were indeed the blooms of wild parsnip, not poison hemlock. However, this past week I have seen that the white flowering poison hemlock is now appearing in great amounts roadside as well. Hemlock's growth pattern is very similar. They too are tall plants, but have umbels of white, not yellow, flowers. My sincere apologies for the mistake. In any case, you should be avoiding both of those plants. Having mentioned the yellow flowers, a wild parsnip, growing roadside, I now must hasten to distinguish between those and the other bright yellow flowers that we've been seeing for several weeks now. Not so much roadside, but covering unplanted fields that in most previous years have been planted to corn, soybeans, or other commercial crops by now. Whether fields have been left barren of crop seed due to the frequent rains or because of the high cost of, well, everything, the uncertainty of a market, or a combination of reasons, as a city dweller, I don't know. In an early summer segment of In the Green Outdoors that I presented several years ago, I did spend some time talking about this plant, and hadn't planned to devote time to it again, but inquiries from several people recently made me think perhaps another very brief discussion may be in order. Crestleaf groundsel, its botanical name is Pachera glabella, is native to the lower 48 states, so although it's obviously very aggressive, it is not a plant labeled invasive. That moniker is reserved for non-native plants that are introduced from outside the U.S. This plant is considered a winter annual, meaning that once the flowers we see now have set seed, the plants die, but the seed remains dormant in the soil until the following year, when conditions are once more suitable for them to grow. Now, I've been seeing folks around the city and county offloading truckloads of bagged mulch and spreading it all around their flower beds and under trees. All well and good, and for those who prefer colored mulch made from who knows what kind of wood. Personally, I prefer arborist chips, and that is chips left from trimming off limbs encroaching on power lines, or cut from trees that have been taken down for whatever reason. The logs may have been hauled away as firewood, but branches and smaller limbs are often chipped. These arborist wood chips are raw, unprocessed, and undyed mixes of freshly chipped branches, leaves, bark, and wood. They work better than processed and dyed mulches, because the important nutrients that help your plants and soil haven't been stripped away and replaced with chemicals. After you lay them in your yard, they'll decompose and interact with the soil in a way that is extremely beneficial to just about every living organism, including your ornamental plants, but not to the weeds that are suppressed below the mulch, believe it or not. Fresh wood chips will not make your soil more acidic, nor will mulching with pine needles do that. They won't change the pH of your soil, nor will they tie up nitrogen or other nutrients as long as you leave them on the surface as opposed to mixing them in with the soil, in which case, by definition, it's no longer mulch. As any organic matter decomposes, the pH moves towards neutral. So while there will be a certain amount of nitrogen tied up at the soil surface where it contacts the chips, this efficiency will not affect the root zone below. Now, since I mentioned mulch, let me remind listeners not to be guilty of creating those horrible mulch mound volcanoes around your trees. This only serves to damage the root system and shortens the lifespan of the tree. I see this mistake most often made around condo communities, where landscapers apparently think they're saving themselves a whole lot of work. Just say no. Now, it seems that within days after one of my segments of In the Green Outdoors airs, I come across more information on a topic I had just presented. This last couple of weeks proved the same, so allow me to revisit a topic that we discussed in May. To follow up on one of these, in which I examined the reasons why some flowers change color as they grow, I would like to add some information I had omitted then due to lack of time. Over a number of years, I've been aware of the changing colors of the flowers of the native wild asters that line the back part of our yard. These bloom enthusiastically from late summer and into autumn. As I was researching this topic of color change, I found the explanation for the color change of the centers of the plants. The disc flowers in the centers of each blossom are surrounded by petals that may be white, blue, purple, or shades in between. These disc flowers of the many aster species turn gradually from yellow to red. Whereas this certainly correlates with the age of the flowers, there is also an evolutionary reason for the change. If you sit and watch as bees move hurriedly from plant to plant, you may notice that they seem to prefer flowers with the yellow discs over those with red. What about these different colored discs makes them more or less appealing to bees that are desperately in need of fuel? Well, the answer is pollen. A closer observation would reveal that yellow discs contain more pollen than those with red discs. Of course, this does relate to age. Flowers with red discs are older and already have had most of their pollen removed. In this way, the color change seems to be signaling that the older flowers are not worth visiting. And certainly the bees notice this. But why go through the trouble of keeping spent flowers? Why not speed up senescence and pour that extra energy into seed production? Well, it's all about cues. Bees, being the epitome of search image foragers, are more likely to visit plants with larger floral displays. By retaining these old spent flowers, the asters are maintaining a larger signpost that ensures continued pollinator visitation, and thus increases their chances of cross-pollination. And, as I pointed out last time, bees do tend to ignore red disc flowers, which they perceive as black. What do most gardeners think of when thinking of planting a garden for pollinators? Butterflies? Bees? Hummingbirds? There are countless other pollinators that often go unnoticed, but that doesn't mean they are less important. In fact, many of them are better at pollination than more common insects. So now today I want to point out some that are not super showy or colorful or large. While people certainly are aware of beetles, flies, and wasps, I'm sure you notice some of them more than others. Perhaps especially the wasps, since those usually trigger warning flags in us. And perhaps you've noticed hoverflies and other bee mimics like the syrphid flies that masquerade as bees and wasps. However, the pollinating flies can be distinguished from actual bees by observing that they have only one pair of wings, while bees and wasps each have two pairs of wings. Typically, when we think of flies, we generally think first of houseflies or even horseflies. But there are at least 6,000 species of flies in the United States, compared to only 850 species of butterflies. And while some of the flies, like robber flies or deer flies, are less likely to be pollinators, most still are considered important pollinators for many different plants. Flies are especially good at pollinating plants with flowers that may smell putrid to humans, or that are colored dark brown, maroon, or purple. Examples of these flowers would be skunk cabbage, pawpaw, and wild ginger. The deep red color and putrid odor of red trillium resembles decaying meat and attracts flies that feed on that pollen. Again, recalling something I said last time, that bees do not pollinate red flowers, that in fact they see the color red as black. Indeed, there's no reason for them to visit red trillium at all, since no nectar is produced in fly-pollinated flowers. This carrion-scented trillium also is known as stinking Benjamin or birthroot. Flies also visit tiny insignificant flowers, such as those of evergreens. If you have boxwood or holly in your landscape, look closely for flies on these plants when they bloom. Taconid flies, for some reason, are drawn to catnip flowers. And when my garlic chives are blooming, those flowers, while they do attract honeybees, are just covered with houseflies. Male mosquitoes, which are related to flies, are pollinators of certain orchids. Dogbane is a common pink-flowered plant that many people mistake for a type of milkweed, And indeed, the flowers are somewhat similar, since they share the same family. But they are not in the same genus as true milkweeds, like common milkweed, swamp milkweed, butterfly weed, or any of the other 10 species that are native to Ohio. Dogbane and milkweeds all flower around the same time in summer, and to the casual observer, the flowers all may look similar. But common milkweed's pink flowers are found in dense, ball-like clusters and can consist of up to 120 flowers, whereas dogbane flower clusters are typically smaller and consist of small white flowers. Dogbane flowers, like milkweed, also are designed to attract butterflies, but while monarch butterflies will nectar on dogbane, they do not lay eggs on it. And indeed, monarch caterpillars that are placed purposely on dogbane leaves will not eat it, but instead would starve to death. When long-tongued pollinators like butterflies visit the flowers of dogbane, however, their tongues become coated with a pollen and cement-like mixture from the flower. Flies and much weaker insects are less fortunate, and these lightweight pollinators often become glued to the flower and die a slow death from starvation. The honeybee actually gets too much credit from people that consider it one of the most important pollinators. Actually, many of the nearly 5,000 species of bees that are native to North America are largely unseen. They are much better at pollinating. We do see our bumblebees, larger native bees, cuckoo bees, and other colorful bees. But sweat bees, small carpenter bees, and many of our specialist bees are hardly observed by most gardeners, or view them askance if unaware of what they are and the services they perform. Beetles are not likely the first insects we think of when it comes to pollination. The ones that typically stand out are the ones that mimic bees. But there are a lot of beetles providing pollination services to a great variety of plants. Actually, this shouldn't be surprising, because since there are some 12,000 species of beetles in the U.S. alone, since there are so many more beetles than other insects, they actually do a lot more pollination than butterflies, bees, or birds. Smaller beetles, even some very tiny ones, do a lot of the work. But there are longhorn beetles, soldier and blister beetles, and leaf-feeding beetles that also are pollinators. Even ladybugs may get in on the act if there are no aphids or other prey handy to feed upon. Ants are possibly the most unseen of all the pollinators, partly because they are so small. While ants are not as good at pollinating as beetles, bees, or flies, they do some pollination and do especially well on plants that have both male and female parts in the same flower. Now, this might be a good time to debunk the myth that peonies need ants to open. That's just not so. The ants are treating themselves to the sticky nectar that is released at the base of the green sepals that surround the buds, and the ants also are keeping other insects away. There are other plant visitors who are incidental pollinators, meaning that they are there for food or nectar, but end up pollinating at the same time just by default. Spiders are an example of this, although those are not insects. Many true bugs, such as shield bugs, plant bugs, stilt bugs, and assassin bugs, also are incidental pollinators. Other insects may include mantids, katydids, grasshoppers, and robber flies. So you see, there are a lot of beneficial life forms in our gardens, and we must learn not to reach for pesticide every time we notice a bug that we do not happen to recognize as common or colorful or pretty. While I've stated this before, it bears repeating. Entomologists estimate that over 97% of all insect species either are benign or actually actively beneficial to ecosystems. Out of the roughly 1 million described insect species we know of, fewer than 1% are classified as serious pests, meaning hundreds of thousands of species are completely harmless. Experienced gardeners have learned over the years to be flexible and to have patience. Each year brings us new challenges, but also opportunities for new lessons to be learned. This is Carol Kelly saying, let's look forward to all the wonderful things that Mother Nature has to teach us this year in the green outdoors.
And there's your show for the week. In the Green Outdoors is a production of WZMO Radio. The show airs Saturdays and Mondays right after the second cup at about 9:30 a.m. If you have a question or comment for Carol or Gail, you can email it Thank you for listening.